everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on forensics when we come back. You know, we Americans talk a lot about private business, and we use terms like private ownership, private property, and private rights. But we also use terms like stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, licenses, and permits in our pursuit of profit and gain in our business transactions. Well, listen to this. Did you know that stocks and negotiable instruments are the exact opposite to private ownership? Bonds are the exact opposite to private property. Public business licenses are the exact opposite to private rights, and permits are the exact opposite to private business. And why is it that we see small businesses everywhere being subjected to such a constant barrage of attacks by government at every level, from Washington to your hometown? And what can you do to protect your life, your liberty, your property from these incessant attacks by government agents and agencies like OSHA, the EPA, your state tax commission, zoning and planning, the IRS, and the swarms of government agents and agencies who are eating out your substance? Well, you know, there's a lot you can do. And the first step is to inform yourself as to the legal alternatives that you have between public business and private business. Now, if you'd like to learn more about private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package, and let me tell you more about what it is you're not supposed to know about private business. Remember, it's educational, it's entertaining, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. The number to call, 417-273-4967, to order yours today. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. It's an easy one, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Forensics. It's the heart and soul of the legal profession. It's what prosecutors rely upon to win those hard-to-be-won convictions. Forensics, it's that one hair that the police found in the trunk of the car that belonged to the victim, which proves that the victim must have been in the trunk of that car. It's the DNA that links the rapist to the rape victim. Forensics, it's all of those things like fingerprints that identify you personally and up close. We Americans are mesmerized by forensics, just like we're mesmerized by science in general. I talked to you last week about this thing of revelation versus scientific investigation. And modern man, and especially modern Americans, have fallen for, have accepted, or have embraced this scientific principle, or, as we say, we have taken it hook, line, and sinker. Is it really true that forensic evidence is absolutely infallible? The hair that they found in the trunk of the car, the fingerprint that we found on the window ledge, is absolutely and unquestionably the truth, the proof concerning this particular case. We'll listen to some of the experts as we talk about forensics. In Charleston, West Virginia, back in 1987, a 28-year-old cemetery worker by the name of Glenn Woodall was sentenced to prison for two life terms plus 325 years for kidnapping and raping two women. The key evidence was medical examiner Fred Zane's testimony that he found Woodall's semen in both victims. Woodall, who fervently maintained his innocence, spent almost 5 years in prison before Lonnie Simmons, his attorney, had remnants of the semen from the victims tested with new DNA methods. Those tests showed conclusively that Zane was wrong, that there was no match with Woodall's semen, and someone else had raped these two women. Well, after official test findings corroborated those ordered by Simmons, Woodall's conviction was overturned. Today, leading forensic experts say that hundreds of inmates in Texas and West Virginia, locked away in prison, may have been wrongly sentenced for murder and rape because Zane falsified and fabricated forensic evidence. So far, Zane, who denies the allegations, has not been criminally charged in either state. Now, Zane, who is 43, was a forensic expert. He was a seriologist for West Virginia State Police for 13 years. Then he was the chief seriologist for San Antonio, Texas for 3 years. But an analysis of his work shows, investigators say, that Zane consistently fabricated or falsified the evidence in just about every case that he touched. Now, according to a report done for the West Virginia Supreme Court, we find that Zane, then, was working for the prosecution and against the defendants for some unknown motive. Now, Zane's job was to compare a single hair, a sliver of skin, or a smudge of blood, semen, or saliva found at the crime scene or on the victim with a hair, sliver, or smudge from the accused. His tools were test tubes, beakers, reactive chemicals, and high-powered microscopes. Results of such scientific scrutiny, if presented accurately, can exonerate innocent people. But investigators suggest that objectivity was rarely Zane's preference. In case after case, Zane's expert testimony served as the pivotal piece of evidence on which prosecutors buttressed otherwise wobbly cases. On September 18, 1992, West Virginia paid $1 million to Woodall for wrongful incarceration. The state instantly sealed the agreement from public view. Puzzled by the state insurance company's secrecy payoff, Bill Forbes, a county prosecutor in Charleston, dug into the matter. We found that the secrecy was instituted to cover up Zane's activities, and that was just plain wrong. There's no way we can tolerate people lying to keep people in jail, especially police officers who use science to find the truth. Zane denied that he had falsified or fabricated anything, and his boss at the time, Colonel J.R. Buckaloo, backed him. Buckaloo, then superintendent of the state police, said his thorough examination found nothing wrong with Zane's work. But out of concern for the integrity of the judicial process, Forbes and other investigators for the state convinced the West Virginia Supreme Court to order a complete examination of Zane's work. The American Society of Crime Laboratory Directors completed the study and told the High Court that the deficiencies of Zane's work were the result of systemic practice rather than an occasional inadvertent error. So the court ruled that any testimony or any documentary evidence offered by Zane at any time in any criminal prosecution should be deemed invalid, unreliable, and inadmissible. Next, the Supreme Court of West Virginia appointed George Castle, a senior West Virginia public defender, to represent prisoners who could document Zane's involvement in their initial prosecution. At least 164 inmates in prison here believe that the evidence, the key evidence presented in their trials, was tainted in this serology lab, and they are asking for a review. And the list is growing each week. Castle's desk in Charleston's public defender's office is piled high with letters from inmates, transcripts of testimony, and laboratory reports. So far, 73 inmates convicted of murder and 65 inmates sentenced for rape have asked to have their cases reopened. This has been an unbelievable travesty of justice, Castle said. And if it's true, then what was Zane's motive? Zane was a prosecutor's dream, Castle said. If he needed blood or semen to match, Zane matched it. If the prosecutor didn't want to match skin or hair, then the samples did not match. He was completely pro-prosecution, and he may have been obsessed by being a hero to these prosecutors and to the police. Now, one question raised by the investigation is how Zane managed to get a serology job in the state police crime lab in the first place. West Virginia State Police require seriologists to have a degree in chemistry and to complete FBI courses in seriology, but Zane had done neither. Copies of Zane's transcript from West Virginia State College and letters from the FBI obtained by Scripps Howard show that Zane failed the required chemistry courses, and Zane received his degree in biology, and it was questionable. The FBI says he also failed the seriology courses. As concern over Zane's performance started to be raised in West Virginia, he was running into problems in Central Texas, where he had moved in 1989. Again, it was a single case that put the first blemish on Zane's reputation. Jack Davis, a handyman, had been sentenced to life in prison for the 1989 killing and mutilation of a woman in New Braunfels, Texas. Zane's medical testimony placed Davis at the scene of the murder. But in a 1992 hearing into misconduct of the prosecution team in the Davis case, Zane's earlier testimony came into question. Zane had insisted that his testing had proven that blood found under the woman's body came from Davis. Now it turns out that Zane never did any testing in the first place. Now, is this just an isolated case of one incompetent laboratory technician who made a mistake, or in this case was totally unqualified not to have had the job to start with, or is there in forensics an underlying problem in science as well as an underlying problem in the character of the scientists who are conducting the science? Now, I'm not attacking forensics per se or science in general or science in particular. As a matter of fact, I'm grateful that we have DNA. And it points something up that's very, very fundamental in criminal prosecutions, and that is 30% of the prisoners who are in jail today nationwide in the United States, 30%, now that's almost a third, almost one out of three, 30% are innocent. And boys and girls, as I pointed out to you in the last program, you know, that's unacceptable. And it's that 9% of the people that are being convicted and put in prison that this law school is concerned about. That's why we bring up from time to time these legal issues, and we point out that the police are not infallible, and indeed the crime labs are not infallible. And it tells us that just because the police come in and say, well, we found your fingerprints on the windowsill, does not mean that that's true. Do you know that there are independent laboratories that can conduct all of these experiments for the defendants? You don't have to rely upon or take as gospel the findings of the state crime lab. In fact, it's been demonstrated for more than 50 years that many, many cases where people have been convicted, not necessarily like this fellow Zane because he had an ulterior motive, but because the science was just plain sloppy. I remember a case one time that came out of New York where a fellow had been accused of shooting somebody. The case rested on the ballistics expert who came out of the FBI laboratory in Washington, or Quantico, Virginia, wherever the lab is located, and testified that the bullet that was fired came out of this man's gun. Now, it just so happens that this gun had rifling in it that had been very, very well worn. And when this same bullet was investigated and the same gun was tested in an independent lab, that expert came in and said, there is no way in the world that you could say that this bullet came out of that gun. It may have come out of that gun, but we could not come to a definite conclusion that, yes, it absolutely came out of that gun because of the worn rifling. Now, that's just one case that I bring up to your attention, in addition to these several cases that are brought up here in Texas and West Virginia. Just how reliable are these forensics? Well, there are unproven techniques that also sway courts and erode justice. For instance, sitting into the witness chair of a Kane County courtroom, Stephen McCassin tutored jurors in a murder trial on the wonders of a very rarely used divining tool. It was called lip prints. The Illinois State Police crime lab examiner told the jury that forensic science accepts that lips have unique creases, and he could match the prints found on the duct tape at a crime scene to the defendant, Lavelle Davis. Now, Davis was convicted and sentenced to 45 years. The lip print, as one juror remembered in the 1997 trial recalled, that lip print proved that he had actually committed the crime. Now, there was just one problem with this lip print evidence, and that is that what McCassin was asserting about lip prints is patently false. The story of how an unproven forensic theory helps send a man to prison might seem like a legal curiosity, befitting an episode of CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, on television. But a Tribune investigation of forensics in the courtroom shows how Davis's conviction exemplifies this questionable science, flawed analysis, and shoddy lab practices that sometimes undermine the quest for justice. Long considered unbiased and untainted, crime labs and analysts are facing new scrutiny today and tough questions about their accuracy. At the center of this new upheaval is the advent of DNA testing, which has injected a dose of truth serum into the forensic tools. With its dramatic precision, DNA has helped reveal the shaky scientific foundations of everything from fingerprinting to firearm identification, from arson investigation to such exotic methods as bite mark comparison. It is difficult, if not impossible, to quantify precisely how many cases have been affected by faulty forensic testimony or poor analytical work, partly because defense attorneys often have not challenged forensic evidence. Many defense attorneys lack the resources to do this, and others assume the science is unassailable, and some simply don't bother because they're lazy. But the 200 DNA and death row exoneration cases nationwide that have come to light over the past 20 years, 200 cases in 20 years, that's 10 a year, offer one clue. More than a quarter, 55 cases with 66 defendants involved forensic testing or testimony that was flawed. Let me repeat that. Of the 200 DNA death row exoneration cases that have been tested over the past 20 years, 10 cases per year, more than a fourth of those cases, 55 cases with 66 defendants involved forensic testing or testimony that was flawed. Now, that's a fourth. Boys and girls, 25% of the people then who are locked up in prison, not just the 30% that are locked up in prison on bum rape raps, but 25% of prisoners who are locked up based upon faulty forensic evidence. So if this ever happens to you, and you're sitting there and you know that you're innocent, you didn't do it, when they say, we've got the fingerprints, or we've got the lip prints, or we've got the DNA, why don't you have that evidence tested privately in your own lab, independently, and at least raise the issue of doubt that, no, that is not the bullet that was fired out of this gun, or at least you can't make that definitive statement. Now, the Tribune investigation included hundreds of interviews across the country, an examination of thousands of court documents, and an analysis of criminal cases that turned on forensic evidence. And among their findings, they found that fingerprinting is so subjective that the most experienced examiners can make egregious errors. This year, in a stunning embarrassment, the FBI was forced to admit that it wrongly linked an Oregon lawyer to a Madrid terror bombing case because of an erroneous fingerprint comparison. Fingerprints, boys and girls, are not absolute. They are subjective. Prosecutors, number two. Prosecutors continue to rely on experts who embrace debunked theories about arson. And among the hard-to-kill myths is called crazed glass, glass lined with a spider web of cracks, which was thought to be evidence of an accelerant until researchers learned that it could occur when hot glass is sprayed with water, as in putting out a fire. Forensic dentists who link suspects to bite marks left on crime victims continue to testify despite having no accepted way to measure their rate of error or the benefit of peer review. DNA testing has shown that even the field's leading practitioners have made many false bite mark matches. Number four, scandals at laboratories from Maryland to Washington State have spotlighted analysts who have incorrectly assessed evidence or have hidden test results helpful to defendants and then testified falsely in court. These scandals underscore the often ineffective standards governing the crime labs. Analysts involved in faulty forensic work typically have testified in hundreds of trials. Just one indication of how widespread the impact of bad science and bad scientists can be. The laboratory scandals also have laid bare a more fundamental failure in the judicial process. Experts often express certitude based upon an unfounded confidence in their forensic specialty and their ability to practice that. Now, I have no problem with forensic science, and I have a problem, though, with the impression that's being given about those disciplines that can make an absolute identification of someone, and that's not the case. Now, that's the testimony of Terrence Kiley. He's a DePaul University law professor and author of Forensic Evidence, Science, and the Criminal Law. It's the white coat and resume problem, he added. They're very, very believable people. And sometimes the jurors will take their testimony as a yes, where the science can only say that it's a possible maybe. The explosive popularity of TV shows such as CSI has led prosecutors and crime lab directors in recent months to complain that juries and the public have unreasonable confidence in what forensic analysts can do and how quickly they can do it. An examination of forensic science's role in the courts, however, suggests that a much broader problem is the case with which prosecutors have brought unproven forensic theories or unchallenged forensic experts into the courtroom. In doing so, they harness the special sway which experts hold in court. Not even police officers are allowed the kind of latitude that is granted to these forensic witnesses, and freedom to give their opinions, not simply what they have observed or what they've heard or what they know, but to give their opinions. Forensic experts and their testimony are being questioned because of two distinct forces reconfiguring the legal landscape. In addition to the advent of DNA testing, the U.S. Supreme Court rulings have sought to impose greater scientific rigor on forensic testimony. In a defining 1993 decision called Dubert v. Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals, the court demanded that such testimony not simply meet the existing standard of general acceptance in its field, but also that it must address some of the hallmarks of scientific inquiry, testing, peer review, and rates of error. And that's precisely what has been lacking in many forensic fields, some of which have scrambled to catch up since the ruling, while others continue to resist. Now, one facet of the problem is that while those involved in the forensic disciplines wear the white coat of science and portray themselves as scientists, they often do not operate under the same rules as those in other scientific pursuits. Crime laboratories regulate themselves, and they often operate without the scientific touchstones of experimentation and validation. Consequently, laboratory analysts have been allowed to testify about such evidence as ear prints and examinations of shoe insoles, though little or no research exists to support their claims that these methods can identify matches. Some respected figures in forensic science say the failure to address such problems and to impose tougher standards is totally unacceptable. Now, the stakes are too high. Life, liberty, destroying families, said Dr. Joseph Davis, the chief Miami-Dade County medical examiner for four decades before he retired in 1996, said that a person who is truly innocent is permanently disfigured or totally destroyed by this false science of forensics. Now, lip prints seal fate. The adversarial nature of America's courts and judicial process is supposed to insulate them from bogus testimony. Both sides may offer their experts. The judge and jury determine what testimony is reliable, and a just verdict is reached. Now, the safety valve malfunctions when those qualified as experts make unsubstantiated assertions, and defense attorneys do not properly challenge those individuals, and judges and juries believe them. Each of those failures was on display in the case of Lavelle Davis's lips, though the questions raised by the use of a lip print evidence do not prove his innocence, but they certainly cast doubt on the fairness of his trial. A week before Christmas 1993, Patrick Ferguson was killed outside an Elgin apartment complex, felled by a single shotgun blast at close range. Well, Davis's first trial ended in a mistrial after a key eyewitness said that she was backing off testimony that she gave at the earlier trial of a co-defendant. At Davis's second trial, the woman said that she was finally coming forward with the truth, that she saw him shoot Ferguson. Well, even prosecutor Alice Tracy called the woman an admitted liar during the February 1997 trial. Now, faced with the credibility problem, prosecutors pointed to physical evidence to corroborate their testimony, to corroborate her testimony and their theory. They believed investigators had found it in the grass not far from the scene of the slaying. It was a roll of duct tape. Tracy theorized how Davis's lip print could have been left on the sticky side of the tape. He might have taken the duct tape to show one of the others what they were going to do with it if Patrick Ferguson started to scream, she told the jurors. So McCassin, who worked at the state crime lab in Carbondale, said that he had examined lip prints in two other cases, though he had been unable to match a suspect to those prints. He had no such reservations, however, in the case of Davis, declaring that the Davis defendant's lips matched those found on the duct tape perfectly. McCassin explained his conclusion by telling the court that lip prints were no different from any other form of what is called impression evidence. It's just a matter of the side-by-side comparison of impressions, he told the judge, who qualified him as an expert. And to that degree, it wouldn't matter whether it was a fingerprint, an ear print, or a lip print. Trying to buttress the credibility of a method rarely seen in American courts, a print examiner from the State Police Crime Lab in Rockford, whose name is Leanne Gray, told the court that the FBI believes lip prints are a positive form of identification. She was mistaken. The FBI to this day has not validated lip print comparisons, said Ann Todd, who is a spokeswoman for the Bureau's lab in Quantico, Virginia. Gray and the Illinois State Police declined to comment on the Davis case because his post-conviction petition seeking a new trial is still pending. For some jurors in the Davis trial, including Doris Gonzalez, the lip print evidence was convincing, much more than the eyewitnesses and others called by both sides, who she said were not very truthful people. Now, that made the lip print evidence crucial. I mean, it was a big breakthrough for determining his guilt, Gonzalez said. And Davis's attorney, Lee Bastioni, repeatedly challenged the methodology and qualifications of the two examiners during cross-examination, but did not hire an expert to counter them. Bastioni instead tried to do the research himself. I basically went to the library and I read all the books that I could find on fingerprints and scientific methods, he recalled. The novelty of the lip print evidence apparently did not trouble the Illinois Appellate Court, which affirmed Davis's conviction in a May 1999 ruling that illustrates how legal safeguards can fail to weed out questionable theories. The court turned aside the challenge to the evidence, noting that the state experts had testified that the FBI considered lip prints a means of positive identification, and they did not know of any dissent inside the forensic science community challenging that assertion. Now, had Bastioni called the likes of Andre Monessens, one of the deans of forensic science in the United States, he would have discovered that many of Gray and McCassin's claims were totally unfounded. A law professor emeritus at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and author of Scientific Evidence in Civil and Criminal Cases, Mons happened to read the Illinois Appellate Court's decision, and he was so appalled that he wrote to the Appellate Defender's Office, and at the request of Davis's appellate attorney, Kim Campbell, Mons agreed to file an affidavit for the post-conviction petition. And he said, you cannot rely on your own cross-examination of the state's witnesses, said Campbell, now an assistant state attorney in downstate McLean County. You have to have your own expert to say what this kind of science is and what it is not, and that it is totally unreliable. And there was nobody saying that at the trial. In his affidavit, Moensens wrote that making the quantum leap to the ultimate notion of identifying an individual by the visible imprint of his or her lips is a journey fueled by two elements, pure speculation and total unadulterated conjecture. Well, the president of the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, the nation's chief professional society for forensic disciplines, was equally blunt in an interview. He said, at this stage of the game, you can put ear prints and lip prints and nose prints and elbow prints all in the same category. Totally unverified and unvalidated, said Ronald Singer, who also is director of the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Crime Lab in Fort Worth, Texas. Now, since Davis's conviction, McCassin has retired from the state crime lab and runs his own document examination business, and he gives frequent workshops around the country on how to be an effective expert witness and has co-written a book on the subject. When told about the doubts raised by the FBI and others, McCassin repeated his defense of his work. "It bothers me," he said, "that the rest of them are wimping out, but they're just worried about being attacked." Pointing to the lip print's apparent similarities on a computer screen at his home near Carbondale, McCassin added, "I still don't see what other choice I had, because there it was, it looked good to me. Those two impressions came from the same person. There's no doubt about that in my mind." Last week in Kane County, a Kane County judge granted Davis a January 31st hearing to make the case for a new trial based in part upon the questions about the lip print evidence. For Mullinson's, the only thing as disturbing as McKesson's testimony was that the appellate courts affirmed his testimony. It doesn't say much for the court's willingness to take the gatekeeper role seriously when it comes to novel techniques and the protection of the innocent, he said. The FBI's fingerprint fiasco is also at issue. Now, though lip prints may never be widely used or accepted, fingerprints have both a long history and the stamp of approval in court and in the public consciousness. And yet, a century of the use of fingerprints and the use in solving crimes obscures a sobering reality, and that is that despite claims that the discipline is an infallible science, fingerprints are neither infallible nor are fingerprints a science. Let me repeat that, boys and girls. Despite claims that the discipline of fingerprinting is an infallible science, it is neither infallible nor is fingerprinting a science. Let me underline that, and let me give you a reminder that you are listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, and agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals but by prearrangement only. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one for yourself. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Fingerprints. There are no standards that exist for what portion of a fingerprint must be recovered before it is suitable for comparison. At most crime scenes, the police usually find only a fraction of a fingerprint. And that latent print, as it is called, frequently is smudged or otherwise distorted, making it difficult to compare. And just as troubling, no research exists to say if people share fingerprint patterns, whether a few points of similarity, or are there many points of similarity, or how many points of similarity may there be. Theoretical problems are just one issue. In 1995, one of the only independent proficiency tests of fingerprint examiners in the United States crime labs found that nearly 25% of these crime lab specialists in fingerprints reported false positives, meaning that they declared prints identical even though they were not identical, and made the sort of mistakes that can lead to wrongful convictions or wrongful arrests. Now, that's 25% of the fingerprint evidence, boys and girls. Hey, these forensics over here aren't quite as reliable as we might have thought they were, are they? Now, a recent episode in a war on terrorism, or in the war on terrorism, underscored these shortcomings. On May 6th, federal prosecutors strode into the courthouse in Portland, Oregon, and they claimed that the FBI had made a 100% positive identification linking a local lawyer to a fingerprint found on a bag connected to a terrorist bombing in Madrid, Spain. The lawyer was arrested, and within weeks, those same prosecutors were forced to return to the courtroom and then admit to the court and to the public that it was an international humiliation. The fingerprint analysis that led to the arrest of Brandon Mayfield was incorrect, and it was totally wrong. But the FBI didn't realize that error until Spanish authorities linked the fingerprint to an Algerian man, Onain Daoud. Now, not just one, but three FBI analysts, all seasoned veterans, not amateurs now, boys and girls, they were all seasoned veterans, three of them, three FBI analysts, all paid professionals, had made the same mistake. Now, a fourth expert, independently appointed by the judge, erred as well when he determined Mayfield's prints were a match. Now, the Madrid fingerprint fiasco was one of the highest profile embarrassments in the century since fingerprinting became one of the most trusted forensic tools employed by the police to catch everyone from burglars and car thieves to rapists and murderers. So let's write that down. There's a 25% error rate. Now, we also saw that there's a 25% error rate in seriologists. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that the police do is an error, or that the crime labs do is wrong, or that the DNA testing is an error. But boys and girls, let's understand a fundamental fact. There are a number of errors that can be introduced into each and every case. Think about it. The seriologist, he can be biased, or even if he's totally objective, it may be that the process that he's using is flawed, which leads him to a flawed conclusion. An honest man reaches a flawed conclusion. Now, when somebody asks me to come out and bid on their house, say you want to remodel your kitchen, we typically get three bids. I put in a bid, two other independent contractors put in a bid, and the fellow who's having this work done does that not because he thinks that the contractors are specifically dishonest or that they're frauds or charlatans, but first of all, he wants the cheapest price he can get, but he wants to make sure that the price of the job has peer review. So when three men come out, they're not all going to come up with exactly the same price. But if one contractor says the job is $10,000, another contractor says it's $11,000, and a third contractor says it's $9,000, they're all within $1,000 of one another. It's 9 to 10, 10 to 11. And so you've got a low end of 9, you've got a high end of 11. And typically there are some odd numbers. It'd be $9,842.20. $10,316.12, $11,514.10, and we come to a conclusion that the job is around $10,000. But what if one guy came in and he estimated $36,500, and another guy comes in with a bid of $9,000? I mean, those guys are so far off that even if a third guy came in somewhere in the middle, say around $20,000, all three of those bids should be thrown out. Something is decidedly wrong here. Either these three bidders don't have all of the facts or information, or they've gone and they've used faulty methodology for calculating these costs and the ultimate price, which says we need to get three more people to take a look at this. Now, notice the FBI did that. They took three fingerprint men on this Mayfield case in Portland, and all three of them agreed. Yeah, it was Mayfield's prints. A fourth guy takes a look at it, and he comes along and he agrees to it. Now, that's pretty convincing evidence. The only problem is that this guy Mayfield wasn't in Spain. And he could show that he wasn't in Spain. So why are these guys saying that it's his fingerprints? Well, his fingerprints were probably pretty close to this guy who was the Algerian. And that demonstrates that fingerprints then is not an absolute science. It's close, but no cigars. Now, even DNA isn't exactly 100%. In the O.J. Simpson case, if you'll remember, that out of a billion cases, there were six people that could have had the same DNA out of a billion. So when you come up with DNA evidence that's six out of a billion, that's pretty convincing stuff. But it's not absolutely infallible. That's my point. And in this lawyer's case, if the Spanish police, if the police in Madrid, Spain, had not found the error, this guy from Portland, Oregon, more than likely would have been convicted on the testimony of four scientists, four fingerprint experts, who would have all testified that it was this guy May over here, when in fact it wasn't. The guy wasn't in Madrid. He couldn't have been in Madrid, because when that bomb went off, he was someplace else, maybe in court trying a case. And everybody knows, well, he wasn't there to do it. He might have hired somebody to do it. He might have paid for it. He might have been in on it. He might have known about it. There could have been all kinds of inculpatory evidence against it. But they said that they found his fingerprints right there at the scene. Therefore, he must have been involved. And, hey, boys and girls, he wasn't there. Now, what does that tell us then? Well, it tells us that when you're in court and forensic evidence is being brought in against you, you should challenge every piece of forensic evidence that's being brought in by the state crime lab. Every piece. If the state's going to bring in fingerprints, you should have those fingerprints analyzed by your own expert. If they're going to bring in serums, then you should have those serums tested by some independent laboratory. If they're going to bring in lip prints or something else, then you should bring in other experts that can testify that, okay, it may be close. It may be compelling evidence. It may be indications of, but it's not verified by any peer review group. This isn't approved science by the FBI or anybody else. And get that on the record for the appellate court. Now, notice in this Davis court, the defense attorney didn't raise that. He should have, and he didn't. Now, that's what we're talking about in rules of procedure. You know, there's 28 things you need to know about putting on a trial. And just because there's 28 things that I'm describing to you, of which this forensics is one, this is called evidence, that's just one element out of 28. That doesn't mean that every attorney in America knows that there are 28 or knows what those 28 elements are. Did it ever occur to you that your attorney may know 27, 15, 18, 21, but doesn't know that there are 28 things that he needs to know in order to win your exoneration or to win an acquittal? Now, maybe your attorney does know, but what if he's lazy on that day and he just doesn't apply himself? What if your attorney is fully persuaded that forensics are so scientific that there's no need for us to come in here and challenge them? We will just accept the state's testimony. Now, boys and girls, you can see that 25% is a big error rate, and it's 25% on the scientists themselves, 25% on the techniques that they're using, and 25% on the conclusions that they're finding. Hey, kids, let's wake up. Forensics are very valuable, and I'm not telling you that we ought to throw them all away and that we ought not to have forensic evidence. But when the government comes in with the forensic evidence, for crying out loud, let's come in and let's challenge it. Let's put a second or third bid in. Let's make sure that all three, that is the prosecution, the court, and the defense, all three are agreed that these fingerprints did in fact come from that fellow over there. Because what happens if you have one guy says, yeah, came from that guy, another guy says, I can't tell, and the third guy says, it absolutely did not come from him. Wouldn't that tell us that, hey, wait a minute, this is unreliable testimony. This evidence is unreliable. Somebody's lying. Somebody may believe he's telling the truth, but he's not. That's the bottom line. In most cases, fingerprints recovered at a crime scene are run through the FBI's massive data bank of prints taken from arrests all over America. And after the data bank spits out a pool of potential matches, then fingerprint examiners compare each of those with the crime scene print. So here's the way this game is played. The police arrest you and they take you in, and they want to fingerprint you. Most people just go through the fingerprinting as a matter of rote. Here in our state, Missouri, it requires a court order to take your fingerprints unless you agree. Now, if the police arrest you and they say, come on over here, we want to take your prints, and you go over and you volunteer, then there's nothing wrong with that. But if you go over and you say, well, I object under Davis versus Mississippi, I don't want you to take my fingerprints without a court order. What's the purpose of the court order? The purpose of the court order is to protect your constitutionally protected rights. Now, if you just voluntarily give the government this evidence, well, then that's fine. That's your choice. You certainly have a right to cooperate with the police if you so desire. But you don't have any duty to do that. I remember one time the police said to me, it's the law. You have to give us your fingerprints. Oh, no, it isn't. I looked up the law. It was Idaho Code 49-28-13 and 28-14, as I recall, or 12 and 13. Yeah, it was 48-12 and 13. And the law requires that the policeman take the fingerprints. The law does not require that the subject give his fingerprints. For crying out loud, kids, let's wake up and pay attention to reality. You know, language, and especially written language, has an intent. It's called the intent of the lawmaker. The lawmakers didn't intend for you to waive your constitutional rights and testify against yourself. That's why we have exceptions written into the law. There's an exception written into the census law. There's an exception written into the vaccine law. There are exceptions. That's why in our state, our Supreme Court, it's Rule 30B2, requires that you get a court order if the guy objects. Now, when the court order comes down and says, give them your fingerprints, then you have to give them your fingerprints. Otherwise, they may have to kill you and take them off of your cold, dead fingers. And if they need to, they will. So when the court order comes down, don't get uppity. But don't give them your fingerprints without the court order. At least make a reasonable demand for your constitutional rights, which most of you can't do because you don't know what your rights are. Here's an important factor for you to factor in here. You can only enjoy, you can only benefit from, you can only have and use the rights that you know about. Now, it's true that we all have 1,000 rights available to us. But there aren't very many people out there that can claim 1,000 rights. At most, the average Joe Sixpack that I run into here might be able to claim 50 or 60 rights. At most. And if you get down here to the average Joe Sixpack, I read your letter here a couple of programs back from a lady who was complaining about the Census Bureau sending her a letter and telling her it's the law and she has to give this information. And she was writing me a letter saying, is it true? Do I have to give the information? Well, I'm not the right guy to ask. The person that you should be asking to provide you with that evidence is the person that's asking. Can you cite to me, sir or lady, madam, the law that requires me to give you these fingerprints? Let me go read this for myself. And then you are the final arbiter. You go read that statute and see if it's the truth. You go read the statute and see who is it that the legislature placed the burden upon. Is it the policeman who has the burden or the duty, or is it the defendant? I think you're going to be surprised. I think you're going to be amazed over here. Now, of course, you can't blame the police. They've got a job to do. And so if they can cunningly coerce you into waiving your rights, if they can intimidate you, if they can convince or persuade you that this is the law and that you have to do this, and then you voluntarily give them the evidence, you don't have any complaint later when you go to trial and they use that evidence against you. And that's just where reality is located. So in most cases, prints recovered at a crime scene are run through the FBI's massive data bank of prints. It spits out some potential matches, and then fingerprint examiners compare each of those with the crime scene print. Don't think for a minute that there isn't disagreement between two or three fingerprint experts as to whether or not this print is a match to any one of those that spit out. Now, it's true that the jury's going to believe whatever that crime lab expert testifies to, unless you can come in there with some countered or some objective evidence that says, no, that's not correct. And after all, that's your job. Hey, we're about out of time again. I'm going to have to wrap it up right here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. And if you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement, and the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. And remember, The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.